This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So I am working on a project on prison art and visuality, and it's very much about color and value. But I'm sharing with you today from a project that a little tiny book that I have coming out in a couple of months. It's called On Racial Icons, and it's really this. It's a meditation. It's I hope to join my readers in decelerating and looking at things that are very familiar to us about around color, race as color and value, and how we create value around iconic forms, specifically looking at photography. So these are images today. The images I'm going to show you are images that you've seen. You've seen all of them. So from early on, I, like many, was aware that my experience of being a young black girl was an experience of living in relationship to images of blackness and black subjects that circulated broadly in the public sphere. As a child, I knew that I had no control over these images and how they were disseminated, but that many of my interactions in public spaces with blacks and non-blacks would be in conversation with these images. I also knew that those images, more often than not, presented a challenge to my very existence, to being able to occupy space without expectation, deficit, or reaction. How did I know these things on such a deep guttural level as early as the third grade, in particular given that I grew up in a majority black neighborhood and went to a black elementary school? So what is this power that we, as a broad American public, affix to certain images of race as color and nation, specifically the black icon? Within this broad category of public images, I am interested in those that are normative to our understanding of race and value. These are images that have a common sense, value, and meaning in terms of the national imaginary and a broad public familiarity with these images. They are interwoven into how a dominant, media-saturated American public understands race as interstitial to the formation of nation. And by American public, I do not mean to suggest that there's one definition of Americans or what constitutes the public, but I'm interested in this as a fraught concept, as a necessary fiction of how various constituents, populations, and individuals make sense of the nation as a collective body. In particular, our and in quotation, attachments to certain public images have come to represent and or substitute for a larger historical narrative of race as blackness in this country. These images are often, they often carry a sort of public burden in their attempts to transform the despised into idolized. In this formal and symbolic characteristic of ideation, they work against the long and visual rich history of degrading racial caricatures. Racial icons, especially in the realm of social and political movements, make us want to do something that impacts us with such emotional force that we are compelled to do, to feel, to see. While the affective response is what one might call the impulse to act or the urgency expressed in some images, our individual and collective actions are not predictable or easy to measure in any specific, linear, or casual way. And this morning I want to focus on our collective mourning that takes place around the posthumous icon as a mode of black artfulness and survival. Here I focus on the production of the posthumous icon through I Am Trayvon Martin campaigns. And first I want to begin by honoring Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin, their families, all who nurtured and influenced Trayvon and who have given us permission to claim him as we have in various public awareness campaigns since his death. So in writing as mourning, mourning in this event as a performative act and of breathing life into the dead, of inhaling and exhaling the arrested breaths of Trayvon Martin, Jordan Davis, Renisha McBride, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, and the many, many others, I enact a mode of racial belonging that is conflicted in its use of substitution and that is also cathartic in its attempt to make visible and to perform a long and continual process of grieving racial violence and morbidity. Black iconicity hinges on a relationship between veneration and denigration, and is this twinning that shapes the visual production and reception of black American icons. Life, one of the many reasons why black subjects turn to the sacred, venerate the dead, appeal to forces beyond the material, speak to and for the unseen, credit a deity for every day and out of this world. Miracles is in racially inflected ways that speak to local and diasporic communities. It's for one basic reason, to declare in spite of evidence all around us to the contrary, that black lives matter. As distinct from energy, to matter, to have a mother, to make an archive for one's life and death, to have material consequences. What we know, on February 26, 2012, Trayvon Martin, a 17-year-old black American teenager, was killed while walking back to his father's fiancée's home from a nearby convenience store in Sanford, Florida. George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch guard, noticed Martin walking, followed him, confronted him, and ultimately shot and killed him. After noticing Martin from his vehicle, Zimmerman called the Sanford police and reported that Martin was acting suspiciously and that he looked like he was up to no good, or, quote, that he was on drugs or something. Zimmerman identified Martin's hoodie, a sweatshirt with a hood, as one of the features that marked Martin as suspicious. According to public records, the dispatcher told Zimmerman to remain in his vehicle, and that an officer would be sent out to investigate. We all know this. However, Zimmerman, as the saying goes, and as the history of American vigilantism and racism reveal, took the law into his own hands and pursued Martin nonetheless. By the time the dispatch car arrived, Martin was lying in a pool of his own blood, fatally wounded. It was not until the next day that Martin's father, Tracy, would learn of his son's fate. When the teenager was not home by the next morning, Tracy contacted the police to file a missing person report. Shortly thereafter, officers arrived at Tracy's home. They showed a photograph of a dead Trayvon Martin and asked if this was his missing son. With little inquiry or investigation, the killing was quickly fought as self-defense by the Sanford Police Department under Florida's notorious justifiable use of for statute, most commonly known as the Stand Your Ground Law. Despite the fact that Sanford police questioned the credibility of Zimmerman's account of the events, Zimmerman was released under this law. Even though the case was initially dismissed, these bare facts no one disputes: that Trayvon Martin was a black boy walking home, that Zimmerman deemed him suspicious, and that Zimmerman killed him. The story of that tragic winter's night in Central Florida does not end there, although Martin's life did. While the local authorities readily dismissed the case, Martin's death reached international attention in large part due to the commitment of his parents to seek justice for their son's murder. Their effort was aided by the viral transmission of information through the internet and the strategic use of Martin's image as part of this campaign. In fact, many people learned about Martin's death through online petitions that were posted on Facebook and other networks, demanding that Sanford District Attorney's Office bring charges against Zimmerman. The outcry and protest of millions, including several high-profile celebrities and public figures, led to an inquiry by the Department of Justice and eventual charges against Zimmerman. A prominent strategy to gain awareness of Martin's death was the circulation of the photograph of him as an ordinary teenager. And I place ordinary in quotation marks because there's little doubt that a black teenage boy is never seen as an ordinary American, let alone an ordinary child who deserves protection and guidance of adults and public authorities. Nonetheless, the photographs used in awareness campaigns by supporters of Justice for Trayvon are striking and compelling, given the context of his death and the state's effort to absolve his murderer. One photograph, the most well-known, is a black and white self-portrait known as a selfie in the social media landscape. The selfie is a form of representation that intimately projects how one wants to be perceived by an audience, especially among one's peers in the digital media realm. The selfie is a contemporary form of vernacular photography, the most widely practiced genre of photography since its inception. In its everydayness and the ease of access that consumers have to photographic software and technology in this contemporary era, the selfie makes self-portraiture a more common practice than any other period in history. Although it often appears fleeting and can be erased in an instant by digital technology, the selfie is nonetheless part of the storied genre of portraiture. Like other portraits, the selfie is a deliberate representation of a public persona, a mode of self-conscious sitting in front of the photographic lens. whether playful, sensuous, earnest, aspirational. The selfie suggests a desire for recognition. It is a request for acknowledgement, an appeal to be a subject of value. In this now famous self-portrait, Martin looks down into the lens with one shoulder raised as if he is leaning. He wears a hoodie. The lighting from above and the cap shaping his face create a halo effect. In the sheath provided by the hoodie, Martin's face appears to float. He hovers and levitates as his eyes peer out from under his hood. The affect is that of a foreshadowing, as speaking to audiences from the silence of death. Even as if it feels as if it were a sort of premonition, Martin's selfie is also a performance of presence. He is, at that moment, alive, self-documenting, and archiving his presence for meaning and circulation. His downward-tilted eyes avoid contact, and yet they reveal an inquisitive gaze. This ordinary boy has captured an image of himself that, after his murder, circulates as a posthumous icon. The boy, who died in large part due to a look that rendered him suspect in public, becomes venerated through a self-image that captures that very look. With this singular photograph, we see how image and context work together to produce an icon. As lethal and vile as racial intolerance and violence are, the forces of love, recognition, and the pursuit of justice are crucial to the emergence of Martin as an icon. We as a public know of Martin's harrowing fate because of the courage and dedication of his parents, who began that online campaign through a petition demanding for the arrest of Zimmerman. The use of Martin's selfie in campaigns for justice led to a form of protest in which millions of people in countries across the world donned hoodies, posed before a camera, and proclaimed, "I am Trayvon Martin." The protest took place on multiple platforms at rallies, small and large, across the country. Groups showed up in hoodies with signs declaring, "I am Trayvon Martin. We are Trayvon Martin." Selfies were posted on personal pages of social media sites with members hooded, somber, and staring into the camera. Others used a black and white silhouetted graphic of a male profile and hoodie. The Miami Heat basketball team took a group photograph of the team hooded with heads bowed. Protesters who claim, "I am, we are Trayvon Martin," were politically, racially, ethnically, linguistically, and geographically diverse. They were representative of how complexly heterogeneous the 21st century American public is. The protests, in this case, express an infinite dynamism and multiple embodiment of racial iconic form, even in its tragic outcomes. The reactions of many to Martin's death register subtle and enormous changes in the United States that can only be briefly sketched here. It marks the profusion and rapid circulation of representation in contemporary era. The number of photographs produced have mushroomed in large part because of the access to low-cost digital cameras. In addition, the Justice for Martin protests speak to changing perception and reception of the icon and what it means to have staying power in a cultural climate where the consumption of images occur more often involuntarily and with such rapidity and plenitude that it makes it challenging to hone in on any singular image. Furthermore, these photo-based protests signal generational and racial shifts among many black and non-black protesters. Masses of protesters imagine and temporarily identify with blackness in ways that are not through minstrelsy, slumming, or parody. Instead, one could argue that these images symbolically demonstrate an identification with racial isolation, profiling, and forms of abject suffering associated with certain groups of blacks and other vulnerable populations in this country and elsewhere. In this light, many non-blacks are able to recognize a young black male as a sympathetic character, as one with whom they form a deeply emotional and performative attachment, a type of claiming, and to see the machinations of structural and quotidian racism to portray him as other. The emotional waves of identifying with Martin reached the White House, whether rooted in perceived or actual public pressure, or a personal sense of the shared experience of racial profiling. President Obama, felt compelled to link his life outcomes to those of Trayvon Martin. Many have argued that as president, Obama has been too cautious in speaking about race because of expectations of many that he should address the significance of racism in the nation's past and present. After growing tensions about Martin's murder and pressure from the public to see justice in Florida, Obama went on record stating, quote, "You know, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon." The president's words affirm what many sympathetic to Martin's parents felt. For some on the front line of protesting, there was cautious hope that Obama would be more vocal and active in his stance against racism. Contrarily, he was widely criticized by politically conservative commentators as and accused of race baiting. Yet even still, after the acquittal of George Zimmerman, Obama seemed to identify even more closely with Martin. He spoke of his own experiences of being racially profiled and then stepped into the dead boy's shoes by claiming Trayvon Martin could have been me. His statement both led some to question what connects Obama to a 17-year-old boy who died so violently, so painfully outside a gated community in Florida, and helped to also ensure that boy's iconic status. Obama's assertion seems even more intentionally jarring, given how very different the backgrounds and outcomes of their lives are. What Obama was signaling was an affective kinship that linked him to Martin in a racial fraternity of being marked as public threats and being subject to extreme forms of violence because of that marking. It is no exaggeration to write that in the weeks and months after Martin's killing, millions of people clung to the selfie of Martin in his hoodie. The attachment to his image and its significance to various constituents of Americans, the attachment to Martin's image and its significance to how various constituents of the American populace understand racialized embodiment, violence, and lack of access to the public sphere grew more palpable during the struggle to have Zimmerman prosecuted for Martin's death. In the days and weeks after his killing, and without any prosecutorial action, protests and identification with him grew more urgent and virulent. And then in a longer paper, I go on to talk about the actual trial, but I'm going to kind of skip over some of that just for time's sake here. On July 13, 2013, after 16 and a half hours of deliberating, we all know this, the jury acquitted George Zimmerman of second-degree murder and manslaughter. Given systemic racism and injustice in this country, some scholars and critics argue that Zimmerman's acquittal was not an anomaly, but an example of the workings of U.S. nation as a racist state. Robin D.G. Kelly, a respected scholar of the Black Freedom Struggles, writes, quote, "The point is that justice was always going to elude Trayvon Martin, not because the system failed, but because it worked. Martin died and Zimmerman walked because of our entire political and legal foundation were built on an ideology of settler colonialism, an ideology in which the protection of white property rights was always sacrosanct. Predators and threats to those privileges were almost always black, brown, and red, and where the very purpose of police power was to discipline, monitor, and contain populations rendered as threat to white property and privilege," end quote. So immediately after Zimmerman's acquittal, there was nonstop coverage and protest against the verdict. I, like many, especially black mothers, felt and still feel heartbroken, demoralized, shocked, and enraged. For so many of us, the series of events around Martin's murder and Zimmerman's release, with the image of Martin at the center of the protests and the trial, is the reopening of a deeply painful wound, or deeply painful many wounds. Since his death, photographs of Martin could circulate as palliation and wound. In some pictures, Martin smiles. Here he floats about on paper and electronically as a thoughtful and loving child and friend. We, the sympathizers and silent majority, are encouraged to see him as earnest, curious, sweet, and innocent. An impossible stands for a black boy in a racial state where blackness is by default suspicious. In a notable photograph used by protesters to untangle the visual and symbolic codes that align blackness with deadly threat, Martin poses with his father, who hugs and kisses his son. Here, a child receives recognition, protection, and guidance. This is a child who is deeply loved and cared for. Yes, a boy was murdered. We love him in all his photographic beauty as another victim of racial violence. This boy, Trayvon Benjamin Martin, was the son of Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin. He was the brother of Javaris Fulton and a cousin and friend to many. He was born on February 5th, 1995, and died one terrifying evening shortly after his 17th birthday as he walked from a convenience store. There is no longer a Trayvon Martin, a living one to flesh out what a photograph cannot contain, his corporeal presence, an experimentation with life's possibilities, a future based in childhood dreams and offspring. There will never be another indexical photograph of an embodied and maturing Trayvon Martin to complicate the widely circulating images of him, especially the photograph of a dead black boy that circulates in his postmortem state. Trayvon Martin is a historical figure. He is a dead black boy. He is an index. He is a specific case. He is symbol and icon. He is all of this and more. Martin's image has been reproduced many millions of times since he died on the sidewalk outside a gated community where he was visiting. He is a goofy boy with a young female confidant, Rachel Gentel. He is an aspiring pilot. He enjoys watching the NBA. He poses with grills in his mouth. There he is, posterized as a Facebook profile, as a flyer passed around to announce a demonstration, as a billboard. On t-shirts and hoodies, he is silhouetted. He is our baby boy whom we want to hug. He's our warning sign of what happens to black boys. He is a threat in the mind of white paranoia. Martin's image moves through various locations and media platforms. He circulates as material object, viral transmission, traumatic wound, and historical fact. He lives through his image because of our attachment to it, our attachment to the historical legacy of blacks, to black masculinity, and to the historical present of racial subjugation. I have never worn a hoodie in honor of Martin. At the same time, I am part of the we-making machine, but I need to imagine that there are others, many others, who share with me the abiding wish that Sabrina and Tracy had their son alive and in their arms. We intimately enfold the image of Martin, smiling from under his hoodie, into our narratives of family, belonging, and love. We publicly memorialize Martin's photograph and murder as part of the long and painful unfolding narratives of race, violence, in the American public sphere. We are not Trayvon Martin. We are alive, but through our lives we breathe life into him and we create matter that sustains his life. Why are we not marching as the millions of others who are terrorized, imprisoned, and killed by the structures of racial violence that devalue black life, such as the many young blacks who have died at the hands of other blacks in Chicago? The indexes of those impacted are so numerous and so quotidian that we gravitate even more strongly to the singularity of the icon, the beautiful face of a black teenage boy peering out from under his hoodie, seeking recognition. When we can isolate the image and hone in on a specific instance, then the emotional floodgates and the historical baggage pour out on the weight of that one boy. And for all its messiness, we rewrite history so that Trayvon Martin did not die alone on a sidewalk outside of a gated community. We carry his body, we wear his mask, we don the hoodie as a declaration that his life matter, that black lives matter, and in so doing, we attempt the impossible task of breathing life into his body and returning him to the loving arms of his father and his mother. Thank you.